Hello, Earth people. Welcome to another edition of the Sensitive Skin Podcast. Can you dig it? I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I am the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And we've got a fun show for you today. Our guest is Tony Duchesne. Tony is just Tony. Tony is the can I call him the godfather of indie podcast? He started doing an interview show called Drinks with Tony probably a good 15 years ago. And he's had everybody's been on that show, from Vim Vendors to Marky Ramone, William T. Volman. Very recently, he had Irvine Welsh. And it was on terrestrial radio for a long time. And just about 6 months ago, he started doing it as a podcast. So check out drinkswithtony.com. And Tony is also the author of the memoir Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk, which was then turned into a film directed by Eric Stoltz. And we talked about both of those things for a while, talked about his journey from being raised in the Jehovah's Witness community to becoming a guy no longer in the Jehovah's Witness community and how that worked out for him. And we had a good talk, talked about a lot of things. And then he, at the towards the end, he'll tell us a story about being on set at Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk, which I believe is now available on Amazon Prime for those of you who have that. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Tony Duchesne.
You're looking sexy. How you been?
I've been all right, says the sexiest man in Los Angeles.
Well, I'll take that, because I mean, I'm not going to try for San Francisco, but L.A., I feel like.
What's the weather down like down there? It's fucking freezing and raining up here.
Well, we're going to get that probably tomorrow, but I was hanging out at the cafe. I'm still in my jacket and beanie, but it's like warm.
Uh-huh.
And but it's been really cold. I woke up a couple days ago at around 8, and I was like, holy shit, it's freezing. And I looked at my weather thing, and it said 36 degrees. And I checked San Francisco, and San Francisco was 44.
Yeah.
So we've actually been getting lower than San Francisco.
Wow.
But I think our highs during the day, like, keep it not so freezing. So
yeah, and if anybody's listening to this in the Midwest or the East Coast, they're, you know, think we're ridiculous.
Oh, are we on? We're already started?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe. Sure, why not?
I thought there was going to be a cue, like, all right, and now, 3, 2, and then that silent one.
Okay. Okay, Tony, here we go. But you 3, 2, yeah. Go. Oh, I blew it. I said go. Oh, man. I put the silent finger up there like they do on the movie. Oh, well.
I love the silent finger. There's just something. Never say one.
Yeah. Why? Yeah. Why is that an immutable law? I don't know.
It's fantastic. It's something that I've grown accustomed to and I always wonder about.
Yeah. But I've been reading and watching some videos of this guy named Wim Hof. Have you ever heard of him?
I don't think so. Who is that?
He's this really interesting guy. He's you know, yet another sort of new age healer type, but he's this Dutch guy, and he's called the Iceman. And
I know him. Yeah, that dude's rad.
Yeah, he'd be ashamed of us. Like, you know, like, it's 45. I'm cold.
Yeah. I love listening to his because he talks. Doesn't he talk a lot about the brain and training the brain in order to?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of his stuff is mental, but he trains people. And there's a great Vice episode where the guy goes specifically to, like, debunk him and show that this is all bullshit. And then he trains him, and he does, like, these breathing techniques. And then he starts you out by going out and standing barefoot in the snow, and you can do it for, like, 3 minutes before you start freaking out. And then, like, by the end of the week of this training, the guy's like climbs up this glacier mountain, like, wearing nothing but shoes and shorts. And, you know,
I love that, because I think we're really digging into what our bodies and our brains are capable of.
Yeah.
And that excites me to no end. It's like, it makes me feel like, oh, we do have a little more control if we work at it.
Yeah, and he's also, as opposed to a lot of these other, you know, outright charlatans who are out there trying to sell you some kind of supplement or whatever. He's been backed by science. They've like proved that he can do this stuff, and he doesn't claim that he like cures diseases, but there's people who've come and done his training who have like cancer or Parkinson's or whatever, and they improve. They get better. Yeah. They need less medicine. They live longer. So.
Yeah, the body's an amazing thing, and I'm so oh my god, I'm so sick of these snake oil. I there's this one guy I want to kill that has.
There's a lot of guys you probably want to kill.
Yeah, not really homicidal. I just like saying that term. I really hope this guy lives a long life, but I despise him to no end. It's the guy that that advertises write your book in 48 hours, and I'm like,
really?
I want to kill you, dude. and I'm sure he's making so much money off of that stupid idea.
Yeah.
But, and then it goes straight to self-publishing and then straight to the family, I guess.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Like your family and friends who you can convince to buy it, I guess.
But, right, yeah. Yeah. Like writing a book is like nothing. It takes 48 hours. I'm just like.
Well, I will say that I think I might have said this on another episode, but I actually did once write a book in 3 days.
Really?
Yeah, and there was a whole
first draft.
The first draft was published. It was just like stream of consciousness. It was pornography.
Really?
Yeah, it was this pornograph back in the days. So this is like in the 80s when, you know, people actually used to buy porn books.
Uh-huh.
If you can imagine such a thing, right? So there was this company, it was called Interconnecting Media, and like I think everybody who wanted to be a writer or whatever in New York City back then, wrote like a book or two. But there were people who did it for like months. They would just, and you'd sit there and you'd basically type like whatever came into your head, and then you made it dirty. And then they'd go, oh, you got 50,000 words. Great. You know, and a week later they'd give you a copy of your book, and it was horrible.
But you had to be dirty, and it's like porn at the same time.
Yeah, it had to be dirty and it was porn. Yeah.
You know, if there was a write your dirty porno book in 48 hours, I would take that class.
Yeah.
I'd go over that. That would be truth in advertising. Let's go.
Yeah. Are you teaching a class now?
Yeah, a couple. Yeah. So I teach. I'm teaching advanced novel writing at UCLA Extension, and then I have a. I just finished a beginning online group, and then I'm starting another online. Beginner workshop in March. Beginning a novel. Yeah.
So have you had anybody come out of those groups who's actually gotten anything published or gotten representation?
Yeah.
Or?
One of my rock star students, CL Ju, she wrote a book called Cake Time, and it's on Red Hem Press. There's about like maybe 8 rock stars right now who are getting close to shopping.
That's great.
And that's, you know, a lot. It's cool that there are a lot of like kind of tourists who come into the class, but when they're in the class, I make everyone travelers at least for the 10 weeks, and then you can go back to whatever you want. But when you're in the class, you're a novelist, and that's it. And yeah, if I could put them on an ice glacier and write their, you know, I'm like.
So do people come out with the first draft after 10 weeks? Is that the idea?
Oh, no. And I don't give them any. I'm like, hey, this is just the beginning of a very long road. What they usually find, I think, by week, because they're, you know, it's people who come in who don't have a lot of experience, and they're excited about their idea. And I kind of call that the honeymoon phase, where you just, you know, it's like, where you're just like, oh my God, I just want to make out with my idea and like, you know, find a corner and finger fuck it or something. But after about 5 or 6 weeks, they're like, oh my God, this is boring me. And I'm like, now you're in the zone. Now you got, now this is when we start doing craft and when, you know, when we really dig in. So I kind of explain to them that this never goes away. It always feels awful at some point. We just get used to feeling awful.
Yeah. Welcome to the wonderful world of novel writing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's okay to feel awful, because all your contemporaries feel awful at some point. So just you have the you have the comfort of knowing that, you know, even a best-selling author wakes up in the morning and goes, how the hell am I going to do this again? You know,
unless you're Stephen King, where you're like, graphomania or something.
He's a machine, but I don't like his novels. I love his essays and I love his anything he does journalism wise. Mm-hmm. But I've tried to read his novels and I can't stand them. I've even gone in 100 pages on some of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I like his essays too. And I will admit that I liked his early novels before he just became this, you know, forest destroying machine. when his books were only like 300 or 400 pages long, like The Shining or Carrie, I guess, or Salem's Lot was another early. The stuff from the '70s when he was trying a bit more, I think.
I should go back and try to reread. I haven't tried to read them in about 15 years.
Yeah,
and you know, I got to tell you, I mean, I did that with Vonnegut when I was younger. I tried to read him when I was like 22. And I just thought I was like, ugh, why can anyone like this guy? Yeah. I reread him at 30 and I was like, what kind of fucking idiot was I? My God. And
interesting. Yeah. I just want to say, I'm not imploring you that saying you've got to go back and read early Stephen King. I mean, it's better than the later stuff. And I kind of liked him there, you know, genre stuff. It's funny, 'cause I was just thinking about Vonnegut just yesterday. Somebody was talking about Cat's Cradle. And I was thinking, I should go back and read that and see if I loved it as much as I did when I was, you know, 18 or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Because sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. Yeah.
I mean, I really didn't get to reading books until I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. I feel like everyone got a head start on me. Mm-hmm. So I've been playing catch up ever since.
Yeah. I'll admit, I didn't really start reading literature till I got into college, and you know, I had a girlfriend who was an English major, and then you know, she was reading these books. I said, "Oh, I'll read them too," and I was like, "Oh, you know, this Faulkner guy's pretty cool." And
yeah,
so, you know, and then I started taking classes with her, or whatever, and that's when I really started getting interested in you know, stuff. I mean, I was always a reader, but I, you know, I was reading, you know, genre stuff. I like, you know, I was reading science fiction and, you know, like Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and Dune and Tolkien and, you know, stuff like that, which is, you know, it's nice, but I wasn't really exposed to anything more interesting to that than when I got into college.
And then was there a book or an author where it just blew your mind and you're like, oh man, I got to do this?
That for me was well, I'll say two things. Okay. So first of all, I remember freshman year of college. I remember a lot of my friends were taking some English survey course and they were assigned Naked Lunch.
Oh, wow. Good one.
Yeah. So,
that'll separate the,
yeah. And I probably hadn't heard of Burroughs probably at that point, you know, and I remember just like going around to like, different dorm rooms and everybody had a copy of Naked Lunch. And I was like, and I would go around and read like 5 or 10 or 15 pages in like someone's dorm room and then go on to the next party and find it there. And that's how I read it the first time, which is kind of a good way. But really, I think the guy who really blew me away was Faulkner. I was big into Faulkner when I started reading that stuff. Absalom, and Sound and the Fury, and let's see. Another thing that was, interestingly enough, was a huge influence on me that made me start to become a writer, and it was R. Crumb. I read some R. Crumb comics.
Really?
And I was like, this is like amazingly deep shit that's going on here, you know, for all the ways you can critique Crumb for his, you know, sexism and misogyny and off the reservation conspiracy theory stuff. There was just like a couple of panels of some R. Crumb comics I read. That's probably in the proper state of mind to really appreciate them. But I've just noticed something. Wait a minute, you've sort of flipped this on that. I'm supposed to be interviewing you.
You're, oh, sorry.
You're,
sorry.
you've gone into drinks with Tony mode.
I'm trying to double dip this. You know you're going to be out. No, I'm kidding. I'm using this for drinks with Tony.
Well, we could do that. We could just make this a shared podcast, I suppose.
I'll be up there in April, so I'm planning on getting you on drinks with Tony then.
Okay. And for those who don't know, Drinks with Tony is Tony's podcast that he's started doing just a few months ago, but this is after many years of interviewing lots of great people, everybody from off the top of my head, Wim Wenders to I'm losing my mind, but you've interviewed so many great people in your in the original Drinks with Tony, which was presented in a format that some of our younger listeners might not be familiar with. It's called radio. It was
the FM, yeah. the frequency modulation. It was on that since 2001, and then I was at Pirate Cat Radio for about 4 years, and Radio Valencia I think for three, mm-hmm. and did the weekly show there. So I taped. For the authors, I always taped the interviews ahead of time, so I had them stacked because they were touring mm-hmm. through San Francisco. It's a lot easier in L.A. because so many authors live in L.A. I just mm-hmm. I throw a stone out the window and I'll hit a bestseller. So
yeah, that's great. And it's funny too. It's just like until I moved to California and started visiting L.A. like for one reason or another, once a year, I got a bunch of friends down there and it's fairly close from here. It's fun to go down there.
Last time I saw you, we did that reading.
That's
together.
Right. Yeah. That was fun. But, I always had like, the Woody Allen, idea of what LA was like from Manhattan, or was it Manhattan? No, it was Annie Hall. Right. And now
what was the quote? He's like, the only cultural thing is you can make a right.
Yeah, right turn
on
a red light. Yeah. And there's like this Paul Simon going, hey, let's get mellow, man. We're just going to hang around and get mellow.
What's crazy is there's so much kind of truth to that in some ways. It's the culture, because being, I lived in San Francisco, like in Bernal Heights, Mission District, and Tenderloin for probably about 15 years total, mm-hmm. and then when I was in the East Bay or whatever. But the energy of San Francisco and the energy of LA are really different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's almost like I have to mellow out when I come down here. I can't. And I'm like, because I'm just like, especially living in the middle of the city where when you're walking, you're commuting. And, you see some idiot stopped and you're just like, there's no room on the sidewalk, dude. Get out of my way.
Yeah, that's what
and
New York
here,
is like.
And then here, nobody
too.
Knows how to walk on the sidewalks and you have to go, excuse me, I know you don't know how to walk on a sidewalk. I'll just walk around you. Everything's cool, man. Stay mellow.
Yeah, there's definitely, some truth to the stereotype. But at the same time, I'm just kind of shocked when I go down to L.A. because I find it so much more culturally vibrant than New York City is these days. New York City has just become like some weird haven for rich people, or Manhattan has at least. And it certainly
wasn't.
That's what
I hear. I don't know that much about it, but I mean, the black box theater stuff, everyone's doing something constantly down here. Mm-hmm. And it's just mm-hmm. like, there's a respect to everyone, even your barista at a coffee shop, they're probably doing stand up sets at night,
right.
or everyone's kind of in the game. So there's a little more respect. And also I think people know how to I love San Francisco, but on so many levels, I'm a San Franciscan 100%, but being down here, I feel like there's less of it. Well, I'm on the East side as well. So I don't know about on mm-hmm. Santa Monica side, but mm-hmm. There's less of a divide. You could be you can watch a big time producer, walk into a cafe
right.
and give respect to a barista and know that they are probably on the same trajectory art wise. He just happens to have the monetary success.
Right.
And it's like everyone's grinding. Mm-hmm. I kind of just get that vibe.
And that's good. And he probably was a barista, 20 years earlier too. So he knows that. Yeah.
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 And then I'm the guy that's, 20 years ago, I was, doing restaurant work. And then I, you know, I go in there and I'm like, wow, you guys are probably making a lot more money than me, but I'm, but it's good to see you. And I'm grinding too.
But yeah, no, I find LA reminds me a lot of what New York was still like in the '90s. Right.
There really?
Was just, yeah. Yeah. And I mean that in the most positive way. There's just New York in the '90s. There was so much going on. There was like a ton of clubs for music and there were, you know, a ton of people doing all sorts of readings. There's tons of art going on and I don't know. I there's still stragglers left over in the East Village, but you know, it's Silver Lake, for instance, reminds me of what the East Village was like 20 years ago.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I live in East Hollywood, which is kind of like the non-hip part, but mm-hmm. I'm right by Silver Lake and Los Feliz and all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kind of like being in the little pocket of
obscurity.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Isn't that where Bukowski lived in East Hollywood?
Yeah, on DeLongpre. I'm actually about 4 blocks away from where
he
lived.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So you said you were a 100% San Franciscan. Is that where you grew? Did you grow up in
I grew up in Millbrae.
Millbrae, so, okay.
Right by the airport. And then I moved to San Francisco when I was in my 20s.
Okay.
So, I mean, as far as you know, as far as my heart. Yeah. I mean, it's like my grandparents and my great grandparents, they all lived in San Francisco. So I was always going to San Francisco to visit them as kids. Mm-hmm. And then because I grew up a Jehovah's Witness. So ever since I was about probably 9 years old, my dad used to take me to Union Square and we would have our watchtowers and preach on Union Square on Saturday mornings every week. Yeah.
Huh. And what is it that made you fall out from the church? If I can assume you're still not a Jehovah's Witness.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about this Bible scripture that I find interesting.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Sure. Hey, there's some great Bible scripture that I come across every once in a while, you know?
I still do like some of the parables and principles of the of the Bible, but there was a the falling out from the Jehovah's Witnesses, it took a bunch of steps for me. And then I wrote Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk, and the film version and the book version was a very condensed timeline of what actually happened, where my journey was about 9 years and I condensed it to about a year to make it interesting. But yeah, there was one of the biggies was, my friend Gibby had killed himself. He had been disfellowshipped, so they shunned him. When you're shunned, you're essentially dead as far as they're concerned. Mm. You went against Jehovah. And he shot himself, and it was about the third or fourth suicide I've had to deal with, and I was about 22 years old. And I asked the elders for help, and I was like, I don't know what to do because I'm so devastated by him killing himself. And they were like, he was already dead. You can't mourn him. They were telling me I couldn't mourn him. And I was having suicide ideations at the time as well. And I'm just like, I couldn't believe the coldness they had. Mm. And that's actually when I started going to the library. You have to go to the Kingdom Hall 3 times a week. So instead of going to meetings, cause they like to take up all your time, I went straight to the library and just started reading psychology books. I read Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins was actually part of my journey of getting out of the witnesses. Uh-huh. But and then I just needed to understand. And then I found poetry because the poetry section was close to the psychology section. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, that's when I started finding out. I was like, oh, wait. The first novel I read that was kind of like a worldly novel that I really got into was James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room.
Oh, good one to start with.
It was weird. Yeah, I don't know why I started with him. I knew nothing about the Beats. I knew nothing about Burroughs. It was like straight to James Baldwin and the emotion in it. And I'm like, oh my God, I feel this. And it was the same feeling I had when I was a teenager and I first heard I was listening to Maximum Rock and Roll, you know, when I was like 14. Uh-huh. It's like I was listening to this demonic hardcore punk music, you know, and I was going, I feel the emotion here, the anger. I understand this.
Was that a frowned upon activity? Did you do that in secret or, you know?
Yeah, I always on headphones. Mm-hmm. And when I was in, they said, never listen to it at night. You know, Satan's going to give you subliminal messages. Mm-hmm. And I used to listen to it at night. And then I'd freak out sometimes and think Satan was coming in my headphones, and I would turn it off and pray to Jehovah.
Well, there's definitely some truth in that, you know, the whole idea. Yeah,
exactly. I always think, like, they always say, you know, be careful if you listen to that type of music or read bad books, you'll leave the Jehovah's Witnesses. And I was like, you know what? They're right.
Yeah. No, I mean, that goes back like like 1,000 years, I guess, you know, to like when there was God's music, there were, you know, Gregorian chants, and then there was the popular music that had different kinds of time signatures that made people get up and dance and got them excited. And they called it the devil's music, you know? So it's hasn't really changed, I guess.
The devil's rad.
The devil's rad. Yeah. Yeah. Although Gregorian chants can be pretty cool too, but you know,
yeah, I've never heard them. I know the Gregorian calendar is all I know. I haven't gotten into the chants yet. I'm still,
yeah, it's very, you know, so yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, check it out sometime.
It almost sounds like something they could be released on Southern Lord Records. It'd be like
they could be. It's funny, there was a time, it was maybe like 15 or 20 years ago, where it became like the hip thing for 3 months or something, like there.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a hit album, I think, but you know, the Gregorian, because people still do it, it's like never died out, they still, monks still do it in monasteries or whatever. So
if I'm understanding your the way you just sang your Gregorian chant, it almost sounds like it could be like a sound bath or a healing type.
Absolutely. It's very, you know, can lead you into a trance and, you know, meditative trances and all that stuff. So, yeah. So then what happened after you were listening to Maximum Rock and Roll? That was your first taste of, the outside world, really?
Oh yeah. Then me and some of my Jehovah's Witness friends, we started buying records. And there was a place in Burlingame, which is near San Francisco Airport. It was a record store called Disc and That. Mm-hmm. So we would skateboard there. And then we didn't know what records to buy. We would just kind of look at the punk section. And we were so scared of, like, the people who worked there, because they were, like, way older than us and could beat the shit out of us. Uh-huh. We just looked at the cover. It was be like, Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bollocks. And we're like, holy shit, I don't know what a Sex Pistol is, but we're buying this. And a Suicidal Tendencies. I don't know what this is, but they're all upside down.
I better get this.
Yeah. And then we'd go home and we'd make mixtapes for each other. And then we'd have to hide those records. And we actually made the tapes and labeled them different. So when our parents...
Wow.
Because your parents kind of regularly go through your stuff. So
it's a very insular society. You don't have a lot of contact with people who don't belong to the church.
Yeah, you actually do, because we did go to high school and we did do the reg. You know,
okay.
Actually, a lot now, from what I understand, they have a lot more homeschooling, so they keep them a lot more insular. But when in the 80s, we went to school, and like kind of the weirdos got homeschooled. And my parents didn't have that much money, and they had no time, so it wasn't like they had resources to do any homeschooling or anything for me. So, and it worked out well, because I got to have, I was trying to be cool in school. I wasn't at school. I was just hoping that people wouldn't make fun of me. I mean, my whole life was just like, you know, I was like, oh crap, because I had to knock on doors. And the hot girls in my class who would never talk to me would answer the door, and I'd be like,
oh wow.
I reconnected with a lot of these people when we had our 20-year high school reunion, and they were all just like, oh yeah, we just thought you were really cool and you just did your Bible thing, but you were always like a cool dude. And I was like, I wish I would have known that then.
Why didn't you tell me?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, my testosterone and the lust in my heart. And then all of a sudden they would show up at the door, and I'd just be like, and I'd be with, like, you know, an elder with me. And I'd be like, oh God, I just, you know, I can't speak. And then he would be like, you know, wow, she seems really nice. You know, you should come back and talk to her about the Bible. And I'm just like sitting there going, I just don't want her boyfriend to beat me up when I get back to school on Monday. Yeah. No.
Did you ever, I have to ask you, did you ever get a chance to meet Prince?
No. Well, no, I was never on that radar. I was leaving. I was married to a Jehovah's Witness until 2008, but I had told her in 1999, like 4 years into our marriage, I said, I'm really out. I'm done. Mm-hmm. I can't go anymore, which freaked her the fuck out. Uh-huh. But, anyway, so she had kept going to the big conventions and stuff. And I know Prince was like at some of those. Mm-hmm. At first I was a little pissed off about the Prince situation because he was starting to claim he was a Jehovah's Witness, but he would still perform Erotic City, but he wouldn't sing.
Huh.
We could fuck until the dawn. He would make a whole crowd sing it. And I'm just like, that's so fucking hypocritical, dude. Yeah. But then he got baptized. And after that, he stopped all of that. And people, you know, I don't have any disrespect for him. Going into the Jehovah's Witnesses and making that choice, he made it in his adult life. It's mm-hmm. not, and even though I completely disagree with the belief system, I he's one of the greatest.
Absolutely,
he's one of the greatest. I mean, as far as I'm concerned,
for sure. But yeah, and, I heard people in LA were like, every once in a while they'd knock at the door and it was Jehovah's Witness, and they opened the door and there was Prince.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which,
yeah,
that would be fun.
And it's like more power to him. Cause I do believe Jehovah's Witnesses actually do work for some people.
Everything works for some people or else it wouldn't exist. Right.
Yeah. Some people, this is funny, but I actually encouraged somebody to go back to the Jehovah's Witnesses. Uh-huh.
Were they just bothering you and you wanted to get rid of them?
No. She had so much of nothing going on in her life and she was in a crap relationship. I was just like, why don't you try to go back and just see? Because she needed a tribe and she had no tribe and she was still feeling tons of guilt. And I'm like, you know, I was just like, I think you'd be happier being a Jehovah's Witness. And it's she won't talk to me now because she's back in. Uh-huh. But at the same time, I felt like that's a good choice for her. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, humans need community. Right.
Yeah.
And wherever you find it, you know, you can find it. And whether it's, I don't know, Jehovah's Witness or the Catholic Church or Bikram Yoga or Scientology, you know, there people.
Let's not get too crazy there.
Yeah. And listen, there's got to be something of value in Scientology and it's got to help people or else there wouldn't be all these people joining, you know, it's not for me. Sure. I wouldn't recommend it, but something's working there, I guess, you know, so.
Oh, I live, you know, that big blue Scientology building that they always show if they're doing any Scientology documentary, they kind of go up on the blue building and it says Scientology.
Right, right.
Big letters. I live about a block away from
that. Oh, yeah. No, I know it. What's the street that's on? It's on the big main street.
Sunset and Fountain.
Right. It's on Sunset. Yeah.
Yeah. And I walk by it and I see them and I say hi to them. And like some of the ladies are so hot. I'm just sitting there going, I'm just like, you know, if you want to go on a Scientology date, I can adapt for.
Yeah, for an evening anyway, right? I'll give it a try.
Right, we can chain smoke cigarettes and wear our pantsuits.
So are you, once you left the church and you told your wife about this, are you shunned now? Are you a shunned person or?
I know. My wife at the time actually begged me to keep it a secret because her whole family was really big time Jehovah's Witnesses, you know? And I did. I kept it a secret because it wasn't like I was leaving and going to and becoming Caligula and having orgies and doing drugs. I wasn't leaving for that reason. I was leaving for, I was just like, I just like to write and I like to film. And so I always confuse the elders and the Jehovah's Witnesses because they're like, wait, we can't disfellowship you because you're not doing anything that's disfellowshipable. I'm just like, yeah. I'm doing my thing. Uh-huh. And, so Yeah, I forgot the question.
I asked if you were shunned when you left.
So I was shunned. I was shunned when people found out that I had a book about the Jehovah's Witnesses.
I see. Okay. They didn't like the book.
Well, they just heard there was a book because my ex-wife, she took off right around that time. And then in order for her to stay good with the Jehovah's Witnesses, she was like, she had to play it up that I had been writing an apostate book and that I was this, you know. Then they go, oh my God, he's a spiritual abuser, which I just laugh because I'm like, I was driving you to the Kingdom Hall and I never said anything disrespectful, you know. Like, I wish they heard our conversations of, oh, that's nice, interesting, that's a good point. Yeah. But so, and then the book came out, and then that completely shunned everybody. I never got officially discommunicated or excommunicated, but the book came out, and even though the book and the film respect the belief system, and just show it, it doesn't even matter. Right. Like, you know, it's not Watchtower sanctioned, so it's apostasy. So.
But you still are in contact with your family, though, right?
My parents.
Only your parents, because I remember you tuned them into that reading we did a few years ago. That was great.
My punchline.
yeah, that was great. So Tony read this story about how his parents met and first had sex in a drive-in movie theater, and how he was conceived. And then at the end of the reading, he revealed that he had his phone on the entire time and his parents were listening in. And yeah, that was pretty great.
Well, you got a good memory. Yeah.
It was memorable. It was a memorable moment. Yeah.
Yeah. I tried to get as dirty as possible. So people are like, why is he talking about his parents having sex? And then it gets even worse. And then in the end, it's just like, oh yeah, mom and dad are on the phone. What?
So what are you working on these days?
I'm working on a short film right now that hopefully goes into production soon as a type of proof of concept for a feature. And I'm working with Sasha Feldman. He was the lead in Jesus Jerk. So I've been working on that with him for a while.
Oh, cool.
He's a fantastic actor and just such a good kid. One of the huge blessings to come out of doing the film was working with him and getting to work with some of those people and just continuing the relationship.
Are you still working with Eric Stoltz?
No, I mean, Eric Stoltz has been on Madam Secretary for about, I think they're going on season four.
I don't know that so show.
I never watch it either. I wish it was my wheelhouse because I would pitch him to about, you know, getting on writing staff or even freelancing, but there's nothing I can offer that show because I have, but he's executive producer, directs a lot of the episodes, and he's also one of the stars of the episode of the show. So he's so in that he's not doing much beyond that right now. Mm-hmm. So, when they cancel, I mean, he's really getting a lot of cred in the TV industry. So when they, after, I'm talking about all this private personal stuff in my head, but I'm not going to dish the dirt for us. I love how you lull me into it. No, but you know, we'll see what he ends up working on next. If he works on a show that's got a sensibility that I can connect with, then, you know, sure. I would love to work with him again on some level. He's fantastic. He was utterly fantastic through the whole process of Jesus Jerk and a pleasure. He just gets storytelling on so many levels. So.
Yeah. He's had an interesting career, I guess, too. Right. Cause he was he considered part of the Brat Pack, I guess, adjacent or something? Or
Yeah. He was very Brat Pack adjacent. He was with, he was around him.
Yeah. And then he kind of disappeared and he was the drug dealer in Pulp Fiction, which was a great role.
Yeah. You know what's funny? I don't think he really disappeared. He just did movies that didn't make anything.
I see. Okay.
If you look at the catalog, it's just like, oh, wait, he was in that.
He's constantly working. If you look at his IMDb page or.
Yeah. And even though people, I mean, he barely acts compared to how much he directs now. He directed a ton of episodes of Glee, and then and so he directed Glee and other TV shows. He was on Caprica, which was the prequel to
Battlestar.
Yeah, and he directed one of those episodes, and that kind of catapulted him into.
Sure I've seen some of those Glee episodes because my daughters were in that prime demographic while that show was on, so that was one of our family watches for a while there.
And he was directing where they had to choreograph where they had the thousand of extras or whatever couple of those where I heard it was just like chaos.
That must have been an interesting show to work on because, again, it was like, pretty wholesome. I mean, there was talk about sex between the students and stuff, but it was a pretty wholesome show. And it turned out that the, main actors were complete degenerates, But,
I don't know. I never watched Glee.
The two main male leads of the show, one of them died in a hotel room of a heroin overdose before the final season.
And not in real life. That was his character.
Yeah. No, in real life. In real life. Yeah. And then, and the other male lead was arrested for child pornography.
Recently. Man.
Yeah. It's pretty. It's like, what the hell is going on with this show? It's like,
that's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The most, I don't know, maybe that's par for the course, maybe the most, wholesome sort of people putting on this wholesome look are the ones you really got to look out for. Maybe that's
being around some of it on a very, because I've done like a lot of extra work, on TV shows. The first AD that was on Jesus Jerk, he was first AD on Glee. And also Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So I was on set for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend a lot. And
really? My kid loves that show.
Yeah. And everyone's just working hard and grinding. Mm-hmm. And I think no matter what it is, I was even on this, I did an episode of a show called Bizarre Fark for Disney. And it's just, no matter what it is, it's like, even if it's Sons of Anarchy or a Disney show, everyone's grinding on the same thing just to get the shots done, to get through it. And it's a trip to watch.
So are there any episodes of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend where I can see you that I should look out for?
Yes. Don't blink. Uh-huh. I was on a lot. I was on a ton, but my head was turned a lot just so I can keep getting on the show.
Okay.
So the first assistant director making sure that I wasn't featured, and I didn't want to be featured. I didn't care. But then there's a few episodes where I do one beer. We did one song about drinking for the guy that stopped drinking, and he's like, I peed in a bush, or I had sex with a bush. So if you don't blink on that one, I'm there. I do get calls sometimes, like on the Mindy project. I was extra on that, and someone just got in touch with me. They're like, dude, I was just binging on the Mindy project and I saw you. And I'm like, oh yeah. I never watched the show, but
it's funny because you just named like my kids' favorite shows. Pretty much.
Tell them not to blink. I mean, it's not like I did anything big. I just ate a lot of craft services, and they said, pretend like you're happy.
What does extra work pay these days? What do you get paid for a day on set?
So, well, I'm in the Screen Actors Guild, so this so SAG is $162 for the 8 hours. But you get bumps.
You get lots of overtime because the shoots last 16 hours, right?
Yeah, they usually go over. I mean, there were times I was there for an hour on one show on the Paramount lot. And they're like, okay, you're wrapped. I was like, wow, this is rad. Uh-huh. But what happens is, they do these other things where if you bring your own costumes, then you get or road robe, then you get more money. If they're late on a lunch or a break, you get penalties. So there's these, and then the overtime's really good too. So the minute you start hitting overtime, you're just like, yeah. There's been times I was on what was that? Let me just emphasize that I was an extra, so I was at the bottom of the barrel.
Okay.
It's a lot of fun because I enjoy the craft and watching people do their craft. Mm-hmm. But I was on the Disaster Artist for a day.
Okay.
And we went 16 hours that day, and I was just drinking coffee because every hour and every like, and then all those penalties, that really racks up the cash. Mm-hmm. But like at 12 hours, they're like, okay, who has to leave? And then people raise their hands. I'm like, I'm sticking around because we're getting into the good money. Yeah. And then James Franco, they're like, okay, he needs an eye line, which means he needs to look at the extras. Mm-hmm. So he's like, who could stay to be, you know, James's eye line? I'm like, I'm fine. And I was just like, you know, just dead tired going, all right. We're like, all right, good. And then, that was a fun long day, but they just sit there and power through it and go home. And
so do you ever get any lines? Because I remember hearing the rule. It's like, if you have more than two lines, you have to be a SAG member. You can get something like, and then if you get over two lines, then there's a huge bump in pay.
No, the bump goes up. I mean, you have to audition for those parts usually. So, I haven't been on set in probably a year and a half on anything. I gotta be more active and just try to be on set two times. But most of the time when I'm on set, I'm writing or I'm going over my student notes. It's just sit and wait. And then they bring you into the soundstage, and then I sit there and I watch the lighting guys, and I'm watching all the different departments do their thing. And it's a beautiful orchestration of, wow, these guys are like honed in and just, they're tight. They know their stuff.
Yeah.
And,
but I mean, I had a friend in New York years ago. I lost touch with him. Really, really nice guy. His name was Bruce. I can't remember his last name. But he did just tons of extra work, and he told me about that two line rule, right? So he's for whatever reason Clint Eastwood loved him, so he's like in every Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah, that's great.
And but like he's like cop number two. You know, I mean, his lines is like, "Hey, what are you doing? Come here." It's funny once you like kind of understand that rule, you see. Like in a lot of shows, there's a ton of people who are getting a lot of screen time, but they only get two lines, and they kind of like trick you into thinking they're bigger characters.
Oh yeah.
And the one I remember was he was in Million Dollar Baby. Remember the boxing movie?
Yeah.
He was in Million Dollar Baby, and he had like what you think is like a really big role. He gets like a ton. He was like the manager. Of what's her name, the actress?
Hilary Swank.
I think he was Hilary Swank's manager or something. He's wearing a black leather jacket, and he's on screen for like 15 minutes. And I was watching; he's got two lines. He's just like he's like show him. And he's like he nods, you know, or like gives like reactions or whatever. But it's like, they didn't give him more than two lines.
And you never know what ends up on the cutting room floor, too.
Right.
We had these two wonderful actresses because we had two party scenes in Jesus Jerk, and during editing, one landed on the cutting room floor, and these two actresses were amazing on set. And then I saw them at the premiere, and I was just like, "Oh crap!" Because I had seen I hadn't seen the final cut, but I saw rough cuts, and I knew that scene was cut out of it, and I was like. "Oh, do they know and I think it turned out they didn't know. And I was just like, oh man, I wish someone would have told them so they wouldn't be disappointed.
Well, there's that the old adage, right? The best stuff ends up on the cutting room floor,
right? I never saw the footage for that one. I understand why they took the second party scene out, but
I think it's unfortunate that it seems like so many films these days, they don't do that. They feel like we got to put all this stuff in here. And
oh, right.
I'm so tired of movies that are like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. You know, it's come on. You know, there's no reason to go over 2 hours unless you're like, you know, some sort of epic film or something like that. But
how long was Roma? I mean, that was my favorite film last year. I don't know.
Yeah, I have not seen it yet. I have not had the, just waiting for the right moment to sit down and absorb it.
Oh,
and
if you could see it at a theater,
I want to see it at see it at a theater. I just noticed that it's playing at an art theater near me in San Rafael. It's like got, you know, shows 3 times a week at 12:30. And I'm like, oh, I got to go, you know, see it in the theater.
I mean, the first time I saw it, I didn't know what it was about. I had no clue. And I cried twice and I was like, oh my God. And the director was there too. And he was talking about it. And then he was making me cry even more because I had no idea what it was about. And then my parents came and visited, and I'm like, and it was playing right down the street from me. I'm like, you guys got to go see this. And I'm like, and I'll go watch it for the technical aspects because there's so many great technical aspects. No, I was crying twice again. Wow. Totally got me again. I was emotional in it. And I'm like, damn him.
Well, he's amazing. That's so Cuarón, right? The director.
Yeah.
He's amazing. I mean, pretty much every movie he's ever made has been great as far as what did he do? He did Y Tu Mama Tambien, which was pretty great. And
he did Gravity, which I totally dismissed. And then after seeing Roma, I'm like, I got to watch Gravity. And I liked watching Roma first and then watching Gravity and then going, okay, cool. That he did a really good job on a studio film. Yeah.
It's a studio film. I thought Gravity was great for what it was. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not expecting to just, I mean, they did the 3D. It's like one of the, as far as I can.
Oh, I should have seen it.
Oh,
in 3D.
You got to see it in 3D. You got to see it in 3D. It's only as far as I've not seen every 3D movie ever made. I generally hate 3D movies. It's kind of a crappy gimmick and they, you know, and my joke is it's 3D because it costs $3 more than like if you go to get the regular movie, right? But Avatar and Gravity were like the two movies where that really, you know, it was just like a bombardment of the senses and it was just wild. Yeah. But Children of Men, I think, is one of the best movies of the century, probably. I'd put it up there.
Yeah.
It's really great. So I'm kind of dying to see it, but I'm holding off till I can see it in the theater.
Yeah, I'm the guy that loves a matinee and a cup of coffee.
Uh-huh.
I love watching my movies with a cup of coffee. I don't know what it is. I'm not the popcorn guy or the, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Matinee, cup of coffee, and watch the movie.
Yeah, I saw it and I tried to watch a movie on Netflix last night, which was it's so interesting what they're doing that they're actually releasing feature films on Netflix. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Which is something that I don't think like HBO's done a ton of like, you know, in-house productions over the years, but I don't think they've ever released stuff in the theater, which is what Netflix is starting to do. So they're becoming like a bona fide studio, really.
Yeah.
But I tried to watch Velvet Buzzsaw last night.
Oh, and
it's terrible.
I saw the trailer and I don't like to watch trailers, but I saw like the first 5 seconds of the trailer and I went, I don't think I can watch this. I don't know. Yeah, but it's bad, huh?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's got a great cast.
Yeah.
And I thought the premise was going to be like a satire about the art world.
Yeah.
And that's how it starts. And it, all in LA and they go to the Broad and they're at LACMA and all over the place. It's pretty.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty. And it's kind of cool because they're like, they're talking about exhibitions at the Broad. And I was like, oh, yeah, I saw that last summer. That's kind of cool. Uh-huh. I know what they're talking about. You know, they're and it's funny. And then it turns into like an episode of Night Gallery. There's like a haunted painting. And I was like, starts killing people. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And I stopped about 45 minutes in. I was like, fuck you.
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck you. Why did you trick me like this?
Yeah, yeah. Where's that director live? Hey, but you know, directors got to make money too. Sometimes you got to dive in.
Yeah, but it had like, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo
and
Malkovich is in
everything.
You know, John Malkovich. And it was like, it was just wasted on this dumb You remember that show, Night Gallery, right? The Rod Serling show?
It doesn't ring a bell.
It was a show he did in the probably late 60s, early 70s, after The Twilight Zone. It was the show he did. And it was every
episode. Kind of like a Creature Features type thing?
No, it was just sort of like, it was like a creepy horror sort of shit. But every episode, it was like he would start out with the painting, you know?
Really?
Yeah, and he would say, and this painting is like, it has an interesting story behind it, you know? And they, you know, use that as like an excuse to, you know, tell some horror story. It was kind of a fun show, but I was like, this is, you know, watching Velvet Buzzsaw. I was like, I wanted to watch. It started out like, you know, all the sort of inside stuff about the art world and, you know, and it was really funny. And it was just like, oh, this is a high production value version of the Night Gallery. Come on. And, and it was dumb. And it just got really dumb really quick. So what are you going to do?
Well, you just, your sigh right there is like my whole life. I wake up and I go.
like so many, like 60% of America these days, you wake up, you go, oh, fuck. You serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. Then there's all, then there's like the political part. I'm just thinking of
just the day to day. Yeah, just the day to day challenge of waking up and getting out of bed and doing stuff.
Yeah. It's like I wake up and I go, oh, every decision I've made is wrong. Okay. Let's try to change this. I'm being facetious, but at the
I know what you mean. No, I heard somebody say, and I thought this was really funny. He's like, oh, you know, you wake up and you're like, it takes you a few seconds to remember like who you are. And then you go, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wait. I looked down. I was like, those aren't 6-pack abs. Damn it.
Well, yeah, I used to have a 6-pack. Now I've got a full case, basically.
Yeah. It's. It's like, because sometimes I'll get like, you know, I do have my depression waves or whatever. And then at the end of last year, like for some odd reason, it was kind of, I was just in a real funk. And then you get in a real funk. And then, well, what helps a real funk? Salami and cheese.
Sure.
You know, and it does for the moment. Your brain is like, great. And it's just like, okay, now I can get through this. And then enough salami and cheese for like months. And then all of a sudden you're like, and then you get out of the depression and you're like, oh, crap, now I'm fat. Now I got to work on this.
Yeah, I've always been so jealous of people who, like, when they get depressed, can't eat.
Oh, I want to be that.
Right, because
yes.
At least when you come out of it, you're like, hey, I look pretty good, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, damn, I can't wait till I'm depressed again. I can fit in my size 32 suit.
All right, we should probably wrap up. It's been a lot of fun. Before we go, I wanted to ask you, so where can our audience find the Teenage Jerk film these days?
It streams on Amazon Prime.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk. Look up Eric Stoltz. He's way more famous than me if you don't know who I am and you're listening, and you'll see it. Teenage Confessions is on Amazon. And then, I've been in rewrites on this novel for about 7 years, and it's about the, my grandmother killed herself 3 years before I was born. So this novel is, the love story of my grandfather and, his wife, my mom's mom before she killed herself. So essentially I love diving into, stuff that makes me need more therapy, but yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm like excited about that book on a weird level, just because I'm in it every day now. We'll see where it goes, and who likes a light touch on a horrid subject. But yeah. I've been the let's do a suicide story, and we'll get Tony because he knows how to do the funny parts.
All right, but like I gotta say. I like the way you put that, that you're writing something makes you need more therapy, right? There's people who think like, oh, I'll write this book and I'll get it out and that'll be my therapy. It's like, no, you're just going to stir the shit up and then you got to deal with it, you know? So
Right. And then when a book comes out, it fucks with you even more. You think, oh my God, that's going to be the greatest thing. I was thinking of putting a support group together of like people who have their first books coming out. Uh-huh. To kind of go, okay, here's what's going to happen.
Right.
One, it's going to feel like nothing. Uh-huh. And then that feels worse than nothing.
I imagine there's a huge postpartum depression, That
Oh, yeah. You're just like, oh, okay. Even with film, I still don't understand it. Where it doesn't make. I mean, I've only watched the Final Cut 3 times, and I couldn't. When we were in San Francisco doing the festival, I can only watch it. I watched it once because that was the first time I could just sit down with Sasha, who played the lead, and me and him got to watch it through. And I think, and we were mostly watching it to see if the audience was laughing on the right parts and silent on the right parts and. Mm-hmm. And it was great to listen to that, but it's just too weird to watch it again. I don't know. I'm veering off. We were ending the show, and then I kept going.
Yeah, we kept. It's my fault. I kept. Yeah, I kept talking. I'm just a chatty Kathy. I can't help it.
This is great. I'm glad you're doing a podcast on sensitive skin.
Yeah, it's fun. It's been fun so far. So we'll see. See where it goes. You know?
Oh yeah. Oh, I hope you keep doing it. I like sensitive skin. I love what you're doing with it. And adding the podcast element, I think it's a great, great, great thing. I'm in.
All right, man. So, why don't you, what are you going to read for us?
Oh my God. I had something that I wrote about, being on set at Jesus Jerk and, I mean, I could kind of – it'd probably be easier just to kind of paraphrase it. But, I mean, I think we talked about some of it. You're like, when you said, what are you going to read for us? I'm like, oh, crap. And I'm like, do I have any – is anything Ghost of Tor readable right now? That's the novel. And I was just like, no, that's not ready. And I was looking at some other stuff. But, I mean, I guess I can just talk about – let's see. We kind of talked about this. I could talk a little bit about the filming of one scene in Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk. And this was off an essay that I had written about a year ago.
Okay. Sounds cool.
Because during the filming of it, I got to stand behind the monitor with Eric pretty much the whole time. And, which is very rare.
I was just going to say that the writer gets to do that. Yeah. That's pretty rare. Yeah.
Eric knew that Eric's sensibilities, he knew I had to stay close because we had to stay in the belief system. And there were sometimes, yeah, at least once a day, I would hear him talk to the actors away from the monitor. And he'd be like, Tony Duchesne. And I knew that meant that they needed an answer to a question that he had. And the actor may not have known how they were portraying it or whatever. So I can come in and give a note. There was one time Paul Adelstein, who plays the father, said fuck, but he's a Jehovah's Witness, so I saw that scene, and he's like, get in the fucking car, and then when he said it, he's like spewing out of his mouth, and I'm like, oh, they're gonna call me on this one. I just like sat back waiting. Tony Duchesne. And I came over, and Eric said, Paul swore on that take. What do you think? And I was like, yes, that take was perfect. And he can swear, but only on this scene. And he was like, thank you very much. And then I walked away. But and on that scene, so that was when Sasha was after he got disfellowshipped from the Jehovah's Witnesses. And so when I was watching, they did take after take after take of this scene where Paul, who plays my dad, comes. It's just furious at his son for what he did and going against the Jehovah's Witnesses. And Paul embodied what my dad was in the like 1980s. Paul was so fucking scary on set because the way wardrobe dressed him, and Eric brought in there's a homage to Eric's father in the film because Paul always wears the glasses of Eric's deceased father. So that was Eric's homage to his dad. But those glasses were the ones that my dad wore when we were young. So we're watching this scene over and over again, the battle of the father and son. And as I'm watching it, reflecting, I was just like, wow, if I knew at 17 that I would be able to just see this and see this like being acted by these amazing actors and directed by this amazing director, and it would become, it would actually come out as a film that people can watch. That that mind blowing concept just continues to it's a blessing and a curse at the same time, but a little more blessing. And Sasha, it's the breaking point of the father son relationship, and Eric and I, he kept making the actors do the retake, and Sasha had to get to a very dark place on every take. And then it was about the 11th take, Eric went and talked to, he's like, hold on a second, as we were behind the monitors, and he went over to where the actors were, and he was whispering a few things, and he came back to me and he's all, dude, watch this, I told Paul to slap Sasha on the next take. And I was like, oh my god, what did Sasha say? And he's like, Sasha doesn't know. I'm like holy shit. He's like, but get this, we're not going to use the slap take, we'll use the next take. Because we need Sasha to have that fear of, he doesn't know what's coming from dad. There is a possible threat of violence, but we need Sasha's reaction to be a little rougher. Well, so Paul on the next take, you know, rolling, you know, it's like sound, speed, rolling, action. Sasha comes out and walks over to Paul, and Paul slapped him so hard he almost hit the ground. And Sasha being the amazing professional, because you cannot break character unless you hear a cut from the director. So he was like, it was almost like Paul like was throwing him into the car. And Sasha went into Tara Summers, she played his mom. He went into her arms like he hadn't any other takes, and he was like weeping into her, and she was pulling him away from Paul, and it was just, everything just turned out so real and beyond real. And when he got in the car, he just broke down on this, where he was like shaking, weeping, and just screaming. He's like, I'm sorry. He just delivered those lines in a completely different way. And that was my first film, first time being on a real film set. So what usually happens is, like, when you're not rolling, all the departments are working on their stuff so they can get out of there on time. So wardrobe's putting all their stuff together. The lighting guys are getting, you know, their C stands or whatever. Everyone had stopped work just to watch this completely, just to watch this whole thing. How far are they going to go? And, that night I was walking to my car with Eric, and Eric is just looking at me. I was walking, trying not to look at him, and I just kept looking to my side, and he was in my peripheral, and he had a big smile on his face, and he's like, how do you feel? And I'm like, I want to kill someone and fuck someone at the same time. He's all, just go home and masturbate, and I'll see you tomorrow. But it was just like, it was way too much. And so I was driving home, and I made sure no one would drive with me to the accommodation so I can do an audio diary. So I clicked on my digital recorder, and all I did was, like, essentially I was just – I taped myself weeping all the way home, because it was just – it was so just – I just couldn't – my emotions were – it was like – it was – one, it was really hard. I developed a relationship with Sasha by that time. So a lot of those scenes were really hard for me to see him go through what I had to go through. So there was these layers of like, oh man, why are we doing this to that poor kid? And then just the memories and just seeing it play out. And I think that was the one night where I went, holy fuck, this is all happening. And I'm actually working on transcribing those diaries and putting together the scenes that were deleted in script form and why they were deleted. So that's another project I'm working on. And then after that, we were in San Francisco for 2 days doing exteriors in the Mission District and Pacific Heights and North Beach. And our production van went by Union Square. And it was just so weird that I'm in a production van with like Eric and all the actors, you know, and crew. Well, we only had three actors, I think, that day in San Francisco, and it was mostly crew. And we're driving by Union Square, and I'm just like, holy crap, that's where it all started when I was preaching on, you know, that's those street corners in Union Square. And the journey is just so surreal and weird and amazing. Even though it was horrific growing up a Jehovah's Witness, how fucking cool is it that I got to tell the story on two different mediums that I never would have thought of? Like, you know, even getting the novel published, I didn't think that would ever happen. And that was the best day of my life. And then it's like, wait a second, people are interested in a film version of it. Like before Eric, I worked with a different producer on a TV version of it. And then that option ran out, and then Eric came aboard, and it was just, and then even when I was writing the screenplay, I was just like, this isn't going to get made. And then it's just all of a sudden we're in production. I'm like, I hope this gets released. Like halfway through production, the first AD came up to me. He's like, dude, we actually ran out of money on yesterday, and production was about to shut down, but we didn't want to tell you.
Oh.
But that night they were making phone calls to get the money to keep the production going. And I was like, I'm so glad you didn't tell me, because I would have just died. And then it gets released, and then that's a whole new thing. So I guess the essay was kind of on, it's, you know, whatever our struggles are in life, they could turn out to be beautiful at some point. And it's really cool to just sit back and think about, you know.
Yeah, that's a great way to, I mean, my personal experience, when I look back on my life, there were things that I really, really wanted real bad. And if I had gotten them, it would have been terrible.
Yeah. Isn't right? it crazy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, man. It's great talking to you.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. This has been a blast.
All right. Well, I hope I see you soon.
Yeah, can we just call each other when it's not a podcast? Because sure. This has been great. Yeah. Can you just be my 8 a.m.?
No, I'm asleep at 8 a.m.
Thanks, man. This has been awesome. I appreciate it, dude.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Don't go yet, though.
Okay.
Yeah.